Oh, beauty, go.
Hey,
everybody.
Hi, Rick.
Hey, Joey.
What are we doing here?
You're surprisingly spriteful for so early in the morning.
It has to do with a ton of coffee, actually. That's exactly what it is. Hey,
Coffee.
welcome everybody to this MVA live activity, this office hours, but this is not our office.
No.
Unless, of course, you have a studio and cameras all over in your office,
and a
which wouldn't surprise me.
And a
But
strange guy on the floor with a fourth camera.
Yes,
So.
exactly. Exactly. So today, well, actually, first of all, we've got a special guest in studio.
Who?
Your new hat.
Oh, yes. Replacement hat. You following my trilogy? Or Dynasty, I think it is,
actually. I think it's come to a dynasty.
I've lost
now.
count, but it's a new one. It's a little cardboard stiff, so I'm working on it.
All
But
right.
We're here, we're good. And more importantly, you are here to be able
Absolutely.
To ask us questions about Windows Server and Windows clients and mostly anything to do around that kind of world. But
Sure.
what are we going to do if no one asks any questions or if no one's online, man?
It's going to be a very long 90 minutes, I can tell you that right now.
Nice.
So you'll want to make
Nice.
Sure that you get your questions into the Q&A panel. We'll get to those. So I believe we have about 50 or 60 slides to go over the next 90
Only
minutes
a few
here.
slides. I've got a few slides that are up here. So actually, can we switch the slides if you could, please? There we go. So look, it is office hours. I'm Rick Laws.
I'm Joey Snow.
And we're technical evangelists. It's a lovely role. Both of us come from a long range of consultant experience and from real world work. They call this work up in the IT pro environments, 20 odd years for myself, 15, 20 odd years for yourself as
Yep,
well.
absolutely.
We're basically doing this as a way of being able to answer questions that did not get answered or that were of particular interest during some other jumpstarts that we did in the last little while.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, now I've done Q&A for a couple of your jumpstarts and then done my own jumpstart
Yep.
when we did it for Windows 8. And it's
I'm sorry to
amazing.
Say I missed yours. I was doing something else at the
Yeah,
time.
that doesn't surprise me.
But
It's amazing the amount of Q&A that we get. And a lot of times, we just when you're up here and you're doing the demos and stuff,
you're
things
focused on
come
the
up here.
content.
Yeah,
you're focused
absolutely.
on the content to make sure you have the best experience to watch the replay. This time, we're focused on the Q&A.
Which I've got sitting right here, and I'm kind of taking a look at things that we've got going on in the Q&A, so get your questions in there now.
This is called MVA Office Hours. You know what MVA is?
It is the Microsoft Virtual Academy.
Yeah, it's a place we can go for free online training. It's bite-sized chunks, if you will, tailored for IT pros and developers on various different topics, and you can basically sign up for it, take a number of different courses. I think I know a couple of people that have helped put them together,
Wonderful.
Joey and I, and others, where it's focused on up-to-date relevant technologies and trainings at MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com. If you haven't gone there yet, you haven't registered, you're missing out. Go there, sign up, it's free, and go off and take some courses and complete them because you get points for it. And in fact, you can get a limited time 50 extra points if you go to aka.ms/mva-oh-voucher and put in the registration code of Office Hours Jan 152013. I love how easy we made that to say to be able to get those 50 extra points for MVA.
Start now.
You got it.
So what are we going to do?
We're here for 90 minutes, my friends. And as you mentioned, there is a Q&A panel just off to the right, and you can actually even go and view the full screen if you wanted to be able to have a better experience of taking a look at that Q&A. Although I do encourage you to keep the window available for the video because we're going to be showing you demos coming up. We're going to try to take as many live questions as possible, but if we can't get to them being actually live, we also have managed to recruit 15 or 20 or so different technical evangelists, product experts, and MVPs, Microsoft Most Valuable Professionals, in there to answer questions that we may not get into as well. So our team is in there answering questions as well. They're going to flag some specific ones for us, but to seed the pot, to see what's going on, I went through my jumpstart from November, I think it was, maybe September, maybe September time, no, November time frame. I forget when it was. It's a
It was a
long,
while
it's been a
ago.
while. 895 questions, if I remember correctly. Just under 900 questions were asked during that entire particular single jumpstart. Do you know how many you had?
A lot. I didn't have mine all neatly organized and everything as you
Okay.
did, but I've also gone through mine. Now, again, I've seen a couple questions pop up around Office and VBA stuff. We're focusing on Windows Server 2012 and
Yes.
Windows 8 today,
Yes.
right? So as much as I'd love to try to answer questions that I know absolutely nothing about. We're going to avoid that and go to something that, well, again, maybe I know absolutely nothing about.
You got it, man. You got it.
So we went through some of these questions. We've got a few things to kind of seed things. Let's start off with a hot topic in both my jumpstart and your jumpstart. Mm-hmm. And it's around storage enhancements. It's around storage enhancements in Windows Server 2012. And the same enhancements exist also in Windows 8. And this, my friend, is storage spaces. So
yes.
Let's talk a little bit about storage spaces, because
it's a little radical on the server side.
Yeah.
Is it radical on the client side as well?
No, it's pretty easy.
Okay. Well, the neat thing I like about this is the fact that storage spaces is technology that you'll see inside the plethora of our platform. How's that for a big word?
Well done.
Storage spaces concept exists in anything from a single tablet or slate device that is RT or even Intel-based slate device allows you to do storage space, all the way up to a desktop, to a laptop, to a touchscreen laptop, to a server, to a rack mount server, to a blade server, to whatever size you want to have. Those particular systems are all able to do storage spaces. And I remember that when I was talking about storage spaces on the server side, people were getting very concerned. They're like, well, I have this big massive SAN investment. I'm used to using that with HBAs and LUNs and VLANs, that sort of stuff. If you have that type of storage environment, continue to use it. It is very fast. It is very useful. And it is, again, it has some qualities that are not present on the storage spaces side of things that are unique and specific to SAN technology. But as far as people that don't have a SAN technology or that have direct attached storage or have my favorite JBODs they can connect up to, just a bunch of disks, they can go off and get, I guess on the server side of things, you would call this enterprise-like capabilities. How would you say that? Enterprise-like capabilities of being able to carve up your storage.
Yep.
And so storage space is the place to start. Do you want me to kick it off, or you want to kick it off? What do you want to do?
Well, let's do this. Let's show the server side first.
Okay.
Because I think that's going to be, you know, if one of those conversations that generated a lot of Q&A the first time. So let's kick that off. And then I've got a couple things that I want to show as well from the Windows 8 side that we were unable to get to when I was with Steven. So you good to go?
I'm just pulling up my demo machine right now, man.
Want me to take off?
No, it's coming. Okay. It's coming.
All right. Remember, guys, get those questions into the Q&A panel. You don't have to raise your hand. Just go ahead and type them in there. We'll get to you. We've also got our panel of expert evangelists and MVPs and other Q&A folks there. So get those questions in now.
Okay. If you flip over to my machine, if you could, here, this is your lovely, everyday, multi-purpose tool called Server Manager. It happens to be installed on a server. Joey's going to be running his off of his Win 8 client machine, if you want to go off and do that. Obviously, you can manage your servers remotely. I'm logged on to a server called H2 at this point in time, but I am remoted into and talking to server number 2 to be able to work. You can see here I have what's known as a primordial pool. This is basically unallocated disk. They're available to be used by a storage space, and I need to be able to go off and create one. Down on the bottom right-hand side, you can see that I've got disk number 2 and disk number 1. Both of them are disks that are available to my system. In this case, I'm going to go off and make a new storage pool. Because basically, the way you start this off is you collect up your disks together with your proper drivers to be able to have access to those individual systems and those individual drives, be it direct attached or through some other connectivity like iSCSI or SAS or shared SAS or whatever. And then you simply go off and you say, make me a new storage pool. By choosing a storage pool, lovely wizard comes up. I'm going to say next, and I want to give this pool a name. You can get as creative as you like. How about pool 1 for my name? Demo storage pool of very fast disks. Here's a quick little tip. From an architectural perspective, when you're setting this up, you want to choose types of disks that are similar in characteristics for speed, revolutions, RPMs, mechanism, that sort of stuff. You don't want to mix and match for performance reasons because it's going to be degraded to the lowest level common denominator.
But they don't have to be identical.
They don't have to be identical. I'm just saying speed. So if they're all SAS, or if they're all 15,000 RPM, if they're all 5,400 RPM, if they're all solid-state drives, whatever it happens to be, try to group them together.
Okay.
Hit next, and it says, okay, scanning this machine, it has the drivers to be able to go off and see 2 physical disks. They happen to be just simply ATA-attached storage, nice and simple. I'm just going to go ahead and select all of them. The more you select, the merrier. And the neat thing about storage spaces is it is enclosure aware. So if I happen to have three or four different network attached JBODs of 30 disks apiece or 7 disks apiece, it knows that it's a, those disks are part of different enclosures, and that'll come important a little bit later on. Now, when I select them all, I can choose how do I want to use these guys. Automatic, which lets the server decide how they're going to be used, or designate this as a designated hot spare. So in case of drive failure, pop this guy in. I'm just going to keep these guys as automatic. Go ahead, say create, and it goes ahead and makes myself the pool. Notice down here at the bottom, I have a create virtual disk when this closes. So once you've gone in and basically associated the disks into a pool, I then can start to make this visible and give it some extra layer of protection, otherwise known as resiliency. So here's my pool one. It's got a total possible storage of 253 gigabytes. I'm going to call this disks. I'm going to call this, how about main fast disks. And then here's where you get to say, how does the data get laid out? And this is where it causes a lot of confusion in the Q&A panel before. Mirror, parity, or simple? You said it could be any size, because the reason why is it basically lays the data across these disks either in a simple environment where it simply stripes the data across the disks, no parity information, lose one drive, you lose the data on that drive. Mirror is a way they can also lay it. Now, it duplicates the data on two or three physical disks. To be a little bit more transparent, it duplicates the stripes of data on two different physical disks. It doesn't take the entire 1.5 gigabyte or 1.5 terabyte drive and stripe it on another 1.5 terabyte drive. When it writes the data, it makes sure that it's located on two separate drives. If you have 5 drives, you can make a mirror, and it will go ahead, and when it writes the data, some will go in one drive, some will go in drive number 4. Next time it writes, it'll go in drive number 2, and then it'll go in drive number 1 as an example. And it basically goes across and stripes that data. It's not the same as a RAID. It's different with the way that it writes. It simply ensures that there is data chunks on 2 physical disks, or 3 physical disks if you want to have 2 different types of protection. The last one is parity. That's the one where you're used to seeing and used to hearing about, where when it lays down that stripe of data, those data blocks, it goes in and generates parity information to be able to recoup in case there's data drive corruption and a drive goes offline. It can recoup and continue to work with one disk failure. So the main thing that I like to make here is mirrored. Now, mirrored means that you're going to get half the storage space, because for every 2 gigs that it writes, it's going to need to have 2 gigs of data reserved for the mirror information. So if I have a 6 terabyte drive, I'm only going to be able to write 3 terabytes worth of information across those different drives. If I chose parity and I have 5 terabytes of data that I want to store, I'm going to be able to effectively write 4 terabytes of data, and then parity information will be sprinkled about on top of that. Similar in concept to RAID, but it's in data chunks and data blocks.
A question has come up in the Q&A panel while we're on this subject matter. Is there a limit to the number of storage spaces that can be created? And I would actually mention the person's name, but I would probably absolutely slaughter it. So thanks for the question, Rick. Is there a limit to the number of storage spaces?
You're limited by your creativity.
Okay.
You're basically limited by your hardware.
Basically, so what you're saying is that for you, it's absolutely unlimited.
As you add more storage to your system, if there's a physical limitation for how many HBA cards you can fit in, or how many drives you can fit inside your chassis, or how many enclosures you can power up, that's your limitation for the number of drives you can have added into the storage spaces, you're good to go.
Okay.
Now, we did the resiliency. The last part is enterprise-class storage capabilities, otherwise known as provisioning. I can say fixed or thin. You know what the difference is?
No, that was actually my next question. To actually explain that, because that was a huge topic in the Q&A panel before. So why don't you hit that?
So fixed is traditional. You're going to say I've got 6 terabytes total drives. I have parity set up, so I really only have 3 terabytes of storage, effective storage space that I can use. If I want to make it more, I can trick the system into saying, you know what, thin provision this, and pretend to the OS that it's really a petabyte of storage. If I wanted to, because you can. What that means is, as far as the OS is concerned, you're going to be able to consume up to a petabyte of space, even though you only have 6 terabytes of effective space. Now, what do you think happens as you get closer to that 6?
It starts yelling and screaming.
It
and
starts to throw event log entries. Red bells and whistles and yellow bells and whistles start to come up to warn you. You need to add more drives and space into your storage pool by adding more into your pool and expanding your disks. So that's how you protect yourself. So I typically tend to be fixed because I'm an old school guy. If I have this much space, I have this much space. Thin is another way you can do it. And if you're familiar with SAN technology, you might be used to using thin provisioning, mm-hmm. add more drives later. There is no performance difference really between them because you're pre-allocating the space up to the maximum that it can go. So, you know, it depends how you want to manage your storage. I'm going to say, for the heck of it, thin, just because I can. And you know what? I said I wanted to have 1 petabyte, so let's go in here and say 1 terabyte. So 1,000 terabytes is 1 petabyte of storage.
You must have a really big server over there.
You got it, man. Hit create. Running, initializing the disks. Completed. All done. Now, so far, this is all simply abstracting the disks and abstracting the drives and what they look like and decide. So when I'm done creating this, it goes off and says make a volume. As soon as you make your volume, it actually shows up in the operating system for the workload to use, like your file shares, like your C drive, your D drive, whatever it happens to be. So I'm going to go in here and say, yeah, this is my server. This is my disk that I created, 1,000 terabytes of space. I say create, and then what drive letter, volume basically, how big do you want to make it? Now, I can actually make it the full size, or I can actually carve it down if I wanted to. So, for instance, I could say, you know what, actually only make this 500 terabytes in size. And assign in a drive letter of E. Why would I want to do this? Well, in case I wanted to have different drive letters carving up that space, mm-hmm. I can do that. Data volume, NTFS, go ahead and say create, and off it goes, creates it. Formats it and makes it accessible.
Now, you just created a petabyte of quote-unquote visible storage.
Petabyte of visible storage to the storage space. Of course,
so,
the format...
So you just tried to create a petabyte of storage and got you obviously did not do your demo god sacrifices.
No, I did not do my demo god sacrifices. I'll go in and make it smaller.
So when you... Those red and yellow bells and whistles, that event loop starts kicking off, and you need to start adding more storage, can you just dynamically add it, not having to go in and make a whole bunch of changes or restart the machine? You can just dynamically add that storage up to that point?
You're able to add more disks in your pool.
Okay.
And then you're able to go in and expand existing virtual disks that are visible.
Okay.
Virtual disks is one layer above the abstraction of the pool.
Right.
Okay. And then you got more space added to it.
And dynamic, no reboots necessary.
You're good to go.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. So another
one thing you can't do is you can't switch your protection mechanism.
So I can't go from
a mirrored to a parity or a parity to mirrored. You can't do that.
Without losing data.
Right. You have to basically destroy and then recreate.
Okay. All right.
Oh, look, my 1 terabyte volume worked. My 500 terabyte, if I changed my allocation size to a larger allocation size, it would have worked. When you're dealing with 500 terabytes, you have to, you know, manage your storage differently than I'm not used to managing 500 terabytes worth of data. So now, basically, I have an E drive that says it is good to go, and I'm ready to go with 1,000 gigabytes or 1 terabyte in size. If I take a look at this now, my E drive on my system, it's available. I can now store stuff to it, I can install stuff to it, and it's all good to go. And it's fully protected because it's mirrored across two systems. And here's that, remember that warning message I said about taking a look at this? You can see here in the right-hand side, percent used, that's my visual indicator, and that will trigger inside Server Manager, inside the event logs, when I start to get close to 80% is when it starts to warn people. It starts to turn yellow, and then 90% it turns red, and then basically it stops.
And that meter is based on what you physically have in the system?
Yeah, okay. Physically in the system.
Easy enough.
Now, you can do all that on a tablet, like... Seriously?
Well, we can do it inside of Windows 8. Yeah, absolutely. But it's a little bit different, and we mm-hmm. don't have up to a petabyte worth of storage. And most of us on our home systems don't have JBODs.
Nice. Mine
does. Well, of course. we're not all. We don't just, you know, build hardware left, right, and center all the time.
You got it.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some pretty good systems, and you know, one of the things I love about this, and there's a great question here that talks about it talks about usefulness in a home system. Now, we all have hobbies, and I know, Rick, one of the things that you do a lot of photography.
Yep.
I do a lot with music, particularly DJing. Those things happen to consume a lot of space,
yep.
Right? And I am the epitome of a pack rat when it comes to my music. And so I will get something and keep it around forever, especially if you go into my office and see all the old vinyl that I have sitting around. So with Windows 8, this is absolutely a valuable piece of technology in the fact that I can do something very similar and be able to expand my storage out within Windows 8. We have storage spaces. So if you want to flip over to my machine here, you'll see here this is Windows 8. And I've got my start screen here. So I'm just going to type in storage staples, which is not a feature. So I'll do storage spaces. We'll go into storage spaces, and you'll see here I've got a somewhat similar interface here. Let me go ahead and elevate up here.
It looks a little more pretty.
It's a lot simpler just because we're not dealing with the complexity that exists in a server site. So I want to create a new pool in a new storage space. You'll see here that I've got a hard drive here. Now, in this case, it's a virtual hard drive. This works with physical hard drives. So, you could add... You've got this really cool little thing in your office, which is essentially it's USB...
It's USB 3.
Yeah.
External 4-drive SATA.
Yeah, and you just go in and throw some hard drives in there. And so the same thing can work here. It can work, I've got a terabyte USB 3 drive, but in this case I've got 127 gig virtual disk. And again, some of the configuration relatively the same, right? So you give it a name. In this case, let's call it Joey's Music Store. And we'll give it the drive letter of, let's give it M because I like M for music. I also have here some resiliency as well, in that we have simple, no resiliency. You've got a two-way mirror, a three-way mirror, and then you've got parity. And just like what you were talking about as it relates to changing, mm-hmm. you need to think about when you're going to make these decisions here, whether you need that parity in order to, that mirror to have a backup copy. In this case, that's kind of where I want to go because it's my music store. I don't want to lose anything. So it basically writes two copies of your data. That way, if a single drive goes down, you're not completely lost there. You'll see here that we've got a capacity. We've got our sizing here, the pool capacity, a maximum size, and then the size converted as it relates to the resiliency. And as it states here, your storage space can actually be larger than the amount of capacity that you have. So I could actually make that 500 gigabytes. And actually go ahead and create that pool. So it's very, very similar to what we have in the server side, but we can do that on the home side of things. So we can take all of this data, your pictures, Rick, my music and everything, we can set it up, we can stripe it for performance, we can mirror it so that we have some parity there. And then, once everything's in there, we can actually go in, we can make modifications to the storage space itself, we can increase the amount of size, we can actually take a look at what we've actually got on that storage space. And it's really super simple, but super valuable, right? This isn't just a server feature that they snuck into a client operating system to say that it's there. This is extremely valuable for those of you at home who are dealing with a lot of media.
Yeah. One thing I will bring up about storage spaces is that the data about the storage space is stored on the drive. And so if you actually take that USB enclosure and unplug it from that particular one system and you plug it into a different system, you're able to basically import that configuration and then start to use it, provided you have the proper credentials.
We had a little bit of experience with that last night.
Yeah, so last night we were configuring the high available cluster that I'm using. I'm using, for our back-end hardware for this demo environment, a Quanta system that is a cluster in a box. And architecturally, I can talk about that when we talk about clustering if you're interested. But basically, it is a 2U unit with 12 drives in the front of it, and those 12 drives are basically accessible and attached by a shared SAS controller to node 1 and to node 2. So both drives can see it with multipath I.O. inside one enclosure. And then you can set up a storage space clustered environment that you can now use. The problem was that there was a demo box, and I had been using it for other things, and I didn't realize that I did not nuke my old storage space configuration prior to re-getting things back up again for today. So, long story short, I was unable to import the configuration settings because at the server level you have to actually have credentials to be able to import it. And the credentials were for a different domain, for a different cluster configuration. Basically, I was hosed. I had to go in. I had to go in and basically nuke the drives to be able to go in and to reuse them again for my storage space.
Yeah.
Another question that came up that I'll just quickly answer here as well. Storage spaces are only available for your data volumes. You cannot make them as part of your boot OS. This is like your D drive and above. So you cannot be for your main OS because the OS has to be initialized to be able to use the storage space. So pretty simple stuff.
There was another question that came up that talks about, and I'm actually very intrigued about this as well. Do you use hardware RAID? Do you use storage pools? Do you use both? Do you use one, the other? Is there any guidance that you've got there, or is it kind of one of those, do you, whatever you feel personally?
My consulting answer is, it depends. Like I said, if you already have a large investment in SAN, you already have SAN technology inside your environment, and it's optimized for being used in your environment, obviously use your SAN technology that you already have, your EMCs, your whatever it happens to be. SAN technology is fantastic and it's great. This concept of storage spaces generally is going to shake up and stir up the market. Performance-wise, it is tracking linearly as you get more scale. And it is able to add a lot of functionality to people at a fraction of the cost because I don't have to worry about a SAN fabric. I don't have to worry about SAN controllers and HBA cards, stuff like that. I literally can use just a bunch of disks that are plugged in. You don't use an iSCSI front end that you then would attach up to. You're literally just attaching up to the network of these particular disks on this JBOD device. That's what I'm doing. You know, one way or the other, it depends on your environment. We stand behind it as being ready to handle the workloads that are supported on Server 2012, no problem. You can take a storage space, make it highly available like we have in the back end as one particular option. You can then also go in and set up a highly available SMB share on top of that storage space. And then that SMB share can be set up to be able to work as a workload SMB for applications, and you can actually store SQL 2012 databases on that SMB share. And you can store VHD files for Hyper-V on that particular SMB share because of SMB3 and have multipath into it, multi-sessions into it, have resiliency in case one node happens to go down of the storage, it still continues to work without a problem. It's absolutely awesome. So it really does depend. To me, I'm all about storage spaces because I don't want to. It's one tool. It's one tool that you're used to using, Server Manager, to manage your storage. I don't have to jump out into vendor X or vendor Y's management software to be able to do stuff.
If I've got hardware level striping or mirroring going on under the hood, it's that is done at the hardware level.
Yep.
Can I then take those hardware level disks and bring them into storage spaces? That was a question asked online here.
You can, but as I said previously, you don't want to because that gets in the way. Literally just want to have your caching and your high-speed access to individual disks. And then from there, you build up your redundancy on your systems. It's mind-blowing for people that have been building servers for a long time. You don't need to do that lower-level stuff. Different manufacturers, like LSI as an example, they're coming out with a native storage spaces driver. You don't have to have that lower-level driver to make those RAIDs and those different configurations. You still want to have RAID and mirroring at the hardware level for your OS and for your system drive. If your data drives, leave them naked and up they go.
Awesome. Awesome.
I think we're done on storage.
I think you just learned me.
I know. I schooled you. We're not even 30 minutes in, and we've done half, one third of this just on storage because it's such an important topic. It was the bulk of my questions that came out with storage.
Yeah, and we got a bunch here, folks. Remember, this is office hours for MVA Live. We're sitting here. We're taking your questions. Put them into the Q&A panel there. We'll get to them as we can. We also have a esteemed team of colleagues that and MVPs and folks that are helping us out there. So get your questions in.
We're
talking about
Windows
Server 2012 and Windows Server 2000 and Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8. It is very early for me still. Yep. So there's a question here that I want to address. It's a couple around Windows 8. Mm-hmm. And so the first one is talk about the differences in Windows 8 versus Windows 7 in terms of performance and some of the graphical things that are going on. So I want to kind of kick off with that really quickly.
Yeah, go ahead, man.
And then take another question around, and it's just fallen off of my screen here. Again, around Windows, where the start screen is, but how to get to the start screen, we'll cover that. So first of all, I want to talk about Windows 7, Windows 8, the performance enhancements. Now, if you take a look back out at the Windows team blog, and as Steven Sinofsky was building Windows 8, there was a great series of blogs that went into in-depth, gory details about all the performance testing and everything that they had done around Windows 8. Now, the main difference in performance that we talk about, we see pretty significant performance gains in startup and in coming back from sleep or from hibernation. That's really kind of where the bulk of these main enhancements are. When you talk about graphical differences, and Jeff, our esteemed producer here, jump over to my screen here. Now, in Windows 7, we had this thing, and we talked about this in the office the other day. You asked me, Joey, where's Arrow?
I know. I'm looking. How come my toolbars aren't transparent? How come I can't see stuff behind?
Exactly. Now, that's one of the things that you'll notice here is not in Windows 8.
Yeah. So it's by design.
It is by design. Absolutely okay. By design. Because the Arrow, yes, it looked pretty. It looked great. But what do you think it did? Used up resources, yeah. Right? And it affected performance. In fact, I know a lot of folks that would turn Arrow off, mm-hmm. you know, in the situation that they needed some performance. And you'll see here, we don't have any of the Arrow. We don't have any of those animations and things that are going on there. So the couple of key things. So graphically, it looks and it feels the same. Now, one of the questions that's come up in the Q&A panel, something that we get quite often, you'll notice in the lower left-hand part of the screen, there is no start button. But if I go down to the lower right, lower left part of the screen,
I never noticed that.
Yeah, that there is start, and that brings you to the start screen. Right now, and on the start screen, you'll see that I have all the icons. I've got everything that I need. I can touch. I've got a touch screen here. I can use my keyboard and I can use my mouse. But one of the things that you'll notice that I do is that when I need to go start something, the start screen is really kind of this one single place that I go to get information. You'll see here that I can customize these tiles, and these tiles will update based on, you know, the latest sports scores or stock things. I can drop off to the desktop. I've got shortcuts on the desktop there. But you can get to the start screen. Also, there's the little Windows key on your keyboard that drops right into the start screen. And you just start typing. So you'll notice that I was talking about storage spaces, and you go in and you can just simply say, okay, type storage spaces. There's no apps, but there's three settings, any files related to it. So that's really kind of a change where we have a single screen, a start screen, kind of a central place. It's very visually appealing. It's great for both touch and also keyboard and mouse. And so really that's kind of where that's gone. Again, it's in the same spot. We're all used to going to that lower left-hand corner of the screen. The other thing, too, is that we also have the charms bar, which is over on the on the far right-hand side of the screen where we can get the start button as well. So, again, if you have a touch, you can swipe to the side or go to the lower right-hand side.
One thing that I've always been trying to figure out, how the heck do I close apps?
Closing apps?
Yeah. Like, if I'm in the modern UI interface, if I'm doing different stuff, like I don't understand, like, I always have all these things popping up and doing things. How do I close apps?
I'm not connected to I don't have the right
the resolution because we have to broadcast this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have to show me, but just tell me.
So I can actually demonstrate this here. Let me minimize my, let's get to the right window here.
I'm completely thrown off.
Because we can actually do it from the desktop as well.
Okay.
So when you're in those Windows 8 applications, first of all, Windows 8 applications, in order to pass the Windows Store certification, in order to be signed off, have to be able to go into this kind of standby mode, this reduced level of resources, almost nil, in order to even pass. So a lot of times, I find myself not even closing applications. Okay. I just let them run.
Yeah.
Right? I just let them run. But if you need to close an application, and I can do this here, and I'm connected via an RDP session, but I can, it still works. On my desktop, you'll see I've got my little hand when I'm up at the top.
Ah.
And I can simply grab it and drag it down.
Right? That's it.
That's it, right? And if I do it via
touch. Do it with a finger, and I can do it with touch, I can do it with the mouse.
Yep, and if I drag my desktop down there, I'm back at my start screen again.
Wicked.
Right? So again, top of the screen, grab it, drag it down. That's how you close apps when you need to close apps. There's also, excuse me, there is also a number of shortcuts. And there's one keyboard shortcut that anytime I get an opportunity to talk to somebody who's new to Windows 8, hasn't had a lot of time to spend with it, who is an IT guy, an IT administrator, it's Windows key X. Yes. And this is what I like to call the IT guy shortcut.
Yeah.
Because this is pretty much all of the things that we do on a desktop PC.
And all these apply, by the way, on server as well.
Okay, so you've got a Windows key X on the server as well. So you'll see here, there's my power options, there's device manager, disk manager, command prompt, the control panel, everything there. And for those of you who really missed run, it's there. If you've really, really missed run.
I just hit the Windows key and then type in what I want, press enter. That's
exactly.
All I do.
Exactly. Run. And it's the interesting thing
works,
I find myself.
Commands too, eh?
Yeah.
Like I can just hit Windows key, shutdown, /S/T1.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's actually how we, when we were starting and restarting and restarting
a lot of
the server yesterday.
/R/T1 for restart.
I do T0. Okay. I just go ahead and do it. Don't even give me a 1 second to
I like
think
the one
second,
it. Just in case.
Okay.
Just I live on the danger side.
You are in the danger zone. So Windows key X, one of my favorite keyboard shortcuts here. And then I just totally lost my train of thought as to where
the
I was.
Next key,
where
I was going, you did start menu, you did closing going, and swiping. Did you do it all?
I think I've kind of covered it. Everybody, we were talking about run. We were talking about run.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talk about kind of this transition to the new operating system. Windows XP has been around over 10 years. We're coming up on end of life, April 14 of 2014. So obviously you need to get those projects to get XP out. But I have a number of systems that are running all sorts of operating systems as we go in and we start talking about migration, we start talking about moving from one operating system to another. And I find myself struggling when I go back to those other operating systems. When I go back to Windows XP, I kind of get stuck because I'd run Windows 7 for so long, so used to just doing that start and just start typing. And I forget, oh, you gotta go start run. And then the search functionality. And I find myself, I don't know if it's the same with you, Rick, but even the same thing when I go back to a Windows 7 machine after running Windows 8, that I find myself, you know, just by nature, I use keyboard and mouse a lot. I mean, I do have some touch devices, but I use keyboard and mouse a lot. I just find myself just, you know, hitting that Windows key with my thumb and typing. And then sometimes I don't always get the desired result. So it's kind of one of those things, once you learn it, it really becomes kind of second nature to you. All right, so we want to make sure that we're answering your questions. As that last little bit on Windows 8 that I was talking about there.
I just answered four of them on the fly there. So.
All right, and Rick's doing that as well.
One came up. Is Windows 8 designed for touch?
Yes, absolutely. Windows 8 is designed for touch. Now, I happen to have, and there's also been a question, what are you guys running now? We're connected. We mentioned your big Qantas server, and that's where a lot of this infrastructure is that we're running.
I'll show you some of that in a bit.
These are just touchscreen
monitors.
Monitors. That's right. Essentially all they are.
So this is a touchscreen monitor that's attached up to, in this case, mine's a Lenovo ThinkPad laptop over there.
Right. So Jeff, you'll see here. I can take my finger and I'm doing this, and if he flips back, there and you'll see the little trail that I've got at the top. So yes, designed for touch.
Yep.
But it's important to know, it works just fine with a keyboard and a mouse.
Right. Like my machine back at the office is just an everyday tower that has two monitors attached to it, and that system is entirely non-touch. It actually is quite annoying because I want to touch the screen all the time,
and I got fingerprints all over the screen. Monitor. Yeah.
And it's like, why isn't this swiping? How come I can't do it? You get used to it, and it just becomes something you expect to see.
Yep. And you saw I was scrolling there. I was just using the scroll wheel with my finger and scrolling there. And then, you know, again, swipe off to the, you can swipe to the side. You can bring up the charms bar. We can bring up settings. This is actually the settings is where we go to power that off. Though us IT guys typically like to use command prompt, so we can just type shutdown there. We've got search here. Windows key Q is actually another one of my favorite shortcuts because you can use that when you're within an application to search that application. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in the Windows Store, I can search within the Windows Store. If I'm in the sports app, I can go in and I can search for my favorite football team. Still haven't gotten over Sunday, but that's all right. Go Texans. All right.
Hey, hockey starting.
Yes. Hey, and the Toronto Maple Leafs are undefeated for the longest time.
I know, but they now are no longer in the race for the Stanley Cup anymore, unfortunately. I've got one for you. Can I talk about something here?
Absolutely.
A couple of quick hits. Very first one for a quick hit, very simple. Someone's asking about what types of OS are available on the install media when you get server, as an example, when you download it. There basically are three flavors, if I can see, four flavors of Server 2012. And those flavors are?
Cherry?
No.
Lime?
No. They are Standard, Data Center, Essentials, and Hyper-V. So really, the last two, Essentials and Hyper-V, are really just kind of variances of the first two. Licensing-wise, each one has their own costs associated with it. Technology-wise, with the exception of Essentials, you can do anything we're showing you so far on any one of those, Standard or Data Center. It used to be that we would restrict what you could do at a technology level based on the addition of the server that you bought. So, for instance, if you wanted clustering, you had to have Enterprise or you had to have Data Center. Now, we don't. We simply have licensing from a virtualization rights perspective. So what that means is if I buy Standard, I can do clustering, I can do high availability, I can do whatever I want, I can do Hyper-V as an example, on Standard Edition. The difference is that with a Standard Edition, when I buy it, I only can license two per socket, two virtual licenses of server on that box.
So that means that you have the ability to run Windows Server 2012 on the hardware?
Yep.
That is licensed for,
in plus addition, two addition virtual guests on top of that are running Server 2012.
All right.
Data Center gives you unlimited. And so the way I look at this is, very simply put, am I going to be running a single purpose workload on a box? I can probably get away with a Standard Edition copy of server when I buy my server. If I want to virtualize a large number of hosts on a box, I probably am going to be more effective at cost-wise at going with a Data Center license on that particular server. Now, Essentials is a special SKU that you can buy that has additional software and configuration to make things easier and limit the number of people that can attach up to it available on a particular server that you happen to be installing on, or you buy it OEM and it's pre-installed and ready to go. That's Windows Server Essentials. That's kind of our area for the mid-market and small business side of things that gives you functionality like ease of access, remote access into the system, gives the ability to use storage spaces, gives the ability to go off and to have 25 users connected up to it, stuff like that. So a nice management console in addition to Server Manager that's in there. That's Server Essentials 2012. The last one is Hyper-V Server. And Hyper-V Server is a unique one because it is free to use and buy. The cost to it, you can go and download it right now. But it does not have a GUI interface. It is designed to have only a command line or core install interface. And it's designed only and exclusively for the Hyper-V virtualizer role, which means that you have to license all of your guest operating systems on top of it. There is no virtualization rights included with the server Hyper-V 2012 server. Those are the four editions of server that are out there. And really, it comes down to licensing the differences between them. You can do high available clustering with the free version. You have to license all your guests. You can do clustering with the Standard Edition. You simply have to license your guests correctly. You can do file and print shares on your Essentials Edition or on your Data Center Edition. So licensing is one question that comes up a lot.
There's one question that's come up in the Q&A that talks about in Hyper-V and the Hyper-V Edition.
Yep.
When you install Windows Server 2012, the Hyper-V Edition.
So Hyper-V Server 2012.
Correct.
Yes.
No GUI?
No GUI.
Can you, and in Windows Server, we can install it as a core edition, which again, no GUI. But in that edition, we can actually add the UI components. Minshell, I believe is what it's called, if I'm correct. Can you do that on Hyper-V Server?
I have never tried.
Okay.
You know what?
That's a fair answer.
And I don't have an ISO in my demo environment because I wasn't expecting this question to be able to try. And I don't even want to theorize or guess because I don't want to give you the wrong answer as to whether or not you can add or remove it.
But you can in Server Core.
You can in Server Core. And I can actually, I can show you that for how to be able to do it in Server Core if you wanted to. Basically being able to add and remove different things. You know what? That makes sense for a great next demo.
Okay.
Yeah. You know what? I wasn't prepared to do that demo just yet, but I'll do it anyway.
Well, actually, while you prep that up, let me also address another question that's gone into the Q&A panel. It talks about in Windows 7, we had something that was called XP mode. And that was the ability to run basically XP applications in a virtualized environment. In Windows 8, there is no XP mode. We do have client hypervisor, or as my buddy Stephen Rose would say, Clipper V, which is actually Hyper-V running on
Windows. That's not an official sanctioned Microsoft term.
No, it's not, but Stephen said it when the last time I was on a Jumpstart, so I had to repeat it here. You do need to have a machine that's capable and has second-level address translation to run it. But I want to be clear. When we put XP mode into Windows 7, that was really for application compatibility. This is not designed. Client Hyper-V can run an XP machine, but I want to be absolutely clear. Windows XP is end-of-lifing, okay? In April of next year, there will be no more patch support. There will be no more updates. There will be no security updates. In other words, we need to get off of this. So while you can run an XP virtual machine on the client hypervisor, don't use this as down-level application compatibility. You need to move away from that, particularly if you're connected out to the internet, because we know nowadays how important it is to stay up to date on patches and those things. So don't use that as application compatibility. Will XP run inside of a virtual machine on the client hypervisor? Yes, absolutely it will. But we definitely want to start looking at getting off of Windows XP. You good to go there with Server Core, buddy?
You know what? Sure.
Okay.
I was trying to keep my demos nice and tidy and have server 1 for my demos for domain controller, server 2 for storage spaces, server 3 for server core. But you know what? Whatever. Throw it out the window. So when I flip over here to my server 2 box, this was the guy that was my storage spaces guy. And what I will show you is I'm actually logged onto the box, and I can very simply go and run Server Manager on the box directly. So this is a full GUI implementation. And I can say Manage, and I can say Remove Roles and Features. And what I want to do is I'm showing you the GUI interface way of taking and managing a box local to itself. I'll show you this remotely in a minute. It scans and finds out what roles are installed. In this case, it's a very generic Simply File Server, and that's it. And then feature-wise, if I scroll down, I have the User Interfaces and Infrastructure option. And here I can see that I have both the Graphical Management Tools Infrastructure, otherwise known as the GUI, and the Server Graphical Shell. If I go and uncheck one guy, what that is going to do is it's going to remove the binaries and the GUI interface, but not the MMC consoles and not servermanager.exe. To be able to go off and to work with this guy. A reboot will be required, and when the guy comes back up again and I log on to him, I will see what I would expect to see as a Server Core box with a command line interface, but I can launch servermanager.exe and it will work. I can also launch gpmc.mmc for group policy management if I wanted to, or Hyper-V manager, whatever I wanted to. I can hit next. It's going to say, hello, there we go. Restart the computer if required. This one does require a restart, and I can go off and do it. I'll double answer a question that was in the queue, which was basically asking, what happens if I had third-party utilities on this particular box that needs to be able to be managed, that requires a GUI interface?
What happens if I have third-party utilities?
Thank you for asking. I can actually go in, install the GUI interface, install those third-party applications that require a GUI interface to be able to run and to manage, configure, work, and everything else. I can then go in my test environment, remove the GUI interface back to Core or Min Shell, see if everything still works correctly.
Oh.
Do your testing. If it does, great. Leave it there. If it doesn't, you can then go back in and then add the GUI back in again, and then it has to stay as a GUI interface system. If it will work as a min shell, which is the management command and the servermanager.exe, then if it works as a min shell, you can leave it that way. A neat thing is, if you need to change any of those configurations on the third-party utility and it requires the GUI, you can always go back in, add the GUI back in, reboot the box, run those third-party utilities that you need to, configure it, and then remove the GUI, reboot the box, and go back to min shell again. You can flip back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I just did this through the GUI interface. Server 3 is now restarting. If I take a look at my interface here, I can see, actually, Server 2 is doing this too. So Server 2 is basically going through a reboot process. You can see my little thumbnail down at the bottom being refreshed. And he will come back up again. He's been up for 15 seconds so far. And I'll be able to log on and have a simple interface that is a server manager, or min shell, as they call it. How would I manage this guy if I want to? If I don't want to log on to him directly?
Well, this is one of the things that I've always been kind of passionate about, because our servers typically sit in rooms that are like 45 degrees below zero with piped in air and huge fans.
Remember me
or
last
your
night?
Office.
I had noise canceling headphones on last night for the most of the evening, trying to not hear the drone of the fan sitting next to me for this 27 drive 2U server in my office.
I believe before your headphones came in, your ears were actually bleeding at some point. But I'm a huge fan of doing remote administration. Now, there's a couple ways you can do this. Right? You can terminal serve into it.
Yep.
We could do some remote PowerShell.
Yep.
And I know some people who are huge fans of just doing everything through PowerShell command line stuff.
Sean Kearney.
Yes. But see, now, I like running my administrative tools on the same system that I do my day-to-day work on.
Mm-hmm.
So you can run Server Manager on Windows 8 and connect to those back-end servers. You could also have another instance of Server Manager running on another server, and you can connect and run it. So just to kind of show you a quick example, since you brought it up, I've got a management machine that I've got here, which is called Win8 Management. And would you be shocked to know that this is a management machine based on its name? And you'll see here, I can open up Server Manager. And I've got Server Manager here. And you'll see I'm connected to one of the servers that you've got in that infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see that I've got the ability to go in and look at Server Manager. You'll see this is also a VDI server.
Go to All Servers on the left-hand side and add in Server 2.
Okay. Server 1?
Server 2.
Oh, Server 2. Okay. Yeah. All right.
It's right mouse click on All Servers on the left-hand side over there. Say add servers.
Okay, add servers. All right.
Query the AD. Just hit find now and list them all because I'm lazy.
I'm very much the same way. And
server two. And then hit add.
And then let's add that there. Click
that's OK. The box I just went in and installed the min shell interface on.
And if I go back to my dashboard, I should also now see that I have multiple servers.
Yeah.
And all sorts of events going on here.
If you go to all servers, you now see servers. Server 2 listed.
You see.
Go back up to the top there. On the window, there you go. Scroll down, you'll see Server 2.
There's Server 2.
He's online. Right mouse click on him. Say Windows PowerShell as an example.
Right.
Or
right.
Computer Management,
computer
whatever.
Management, everything else.
You're managing that headless box from a Windows 8 machine with RSAT tools installed.
Yep, absolutely. The way to do it. Now, RSAT tools freely downloadable, freely available.
Do they work on Windows XP?
Do they work on Windows XP? The RSAT tools for Windows Server 2012, do they work on Windows XP?
Yeah, because that's what I work with.
I'm going to say no.
Okay, Windows 7.
Yes. However, RSAT for Windows 7, it is available, but it does not manage Windows Server 2012 machines.
Ooh, tricky. See,
so like, you tried to trap me there.
That's like a Microsoft exam question.
It is. I kind of did the juke.
Because I'm just about to say, what? They don't do that.
There are RSAT tools available for Windows Server 2008 R2.
Think of it as taking a client in parity with the server that came out around the same time.
Yeah.
That's how RSAT works.
Mm-hmm.
It's always worked that way. You manage Win7, you can manage 2008 R2. You want to go in and manage 2012, you have to have Win8 to be able to manage Win8 on the system.
So that's absolutely right. So
easy
Windows 8, you need to you need Windows 8 to manage Windows Server 2008 R2. It's a package that you can download, and it's also available, folks, for both the 64-bit version and 32-bit version of the operating system. You go, you download that package. It's essentially a Windows update that starts off. And then once that's there, you can go ahead and choose to add the components that you want to actually manage. You saw that I have Server Manager here, right? If I want to add additional components to do that, I'm just going to type in... Here, I'm going to type in add features in my search, and you'll see there I'm going to turn Windows features on or off, and we should be pretty familiar with that. Oh, hey, look, topic we talked about earlier, Hyper-V.
Yeah.
Where I would actually go in to add Hyper-V.
Yeah.
But you will see here, I've got this remote server administration tools. And you can manage features, you can manage roles, and you just add all of those things that you want to do there. And interestingly enough, Rick, since you brought it up, I've created my own customized MMC console.
Oh, nice.
That I use on this system.
Yeah.
So you'll see here, we're running all these virtual machines in a failover cluster, right? So I've gone in and I'm using Failover Cluster Manager to manage and monitor that. We're going to be hopefully talking about some group policy stuff, or just in case I was working on some group policy stuff. So I've got some group policy management here. I've got one of my favorite tools in Active Directory users and computers here, and also some remote desktop gateway manager services here.
Yep.
All my own customized console. If I want to go in and add another snap-in, again, it's the same way we do it on a server, right?
Yep.
So if I wanted to, I don't know, let's pick something, DHCP, right? I just simply go in, I add DHCP, I click OK, and boom, I've got DHCP management. I can go ahead and add a server. And we've got one DHCP server, and you'll see there, now I'm managing DHCP right here from my desktop machine.
So I will one-up you on that one there, because what I do normally is I just run one tool, Server Manager, because I can right-mouse click on any one of my systems in Server Manager and launch those individual MMCs targeted specifically at that particular system as I need to, as opposed to a custom.
So in this case... Like if I'm on here and I go to all servers and I want to do something here,
This is my box. There you go. His box.
Yeah.
Right mouse click on him. Context sensitive wise, it knows that is a Hyper-V manager guy and a failover cluster guy. You go down.
Oh, nice.
And then go over and choose your all servers. Choose server one, or server two down there in your list. Server two. Right mouse click on him. He's just a file and print server, so nothing specific comes up there.
Oh, very cool.
If you add in your domain controller in there, you right mouse click on him, your AD tools will show up in there.
Ooh.
So that's context sensitive, even better. But I also...
That's pretty cool. See, I was doing it the old school way.
I know, and this is the new school way, dude.
I am such like, an old dog.
We're like peanut butter and jelly. We're just good together, my friend. We're just good together.
Folks, make sure you ask your questions in the Q&A panel, because that's why we're here.
Yeah.
It's office hours with Rick and Joey. So I want to cover something that kind of came up in the Q&A panel as it relates to Internet Explorer.
Okay.
And Windows 8. And I'm going to actually show this here. I'll jump over to this machine. These machines are not currently connected to the Internet, but I can show this anyway. You'll notice here I'm in the desktop. So we've got desktop applications, which are kind of your classic style of applications, your Windows 7 type of applications. Question that I constantly get all the time, what applications are compatible with Windows 8? If it runs on Windows 7, it should run in Windows 8, right? As long as you're running Windows 8 or Windows 8 Pro, Windows 8 Enterprise, it will run Windows RT. A little different story. We'll get to that a little bit later. But you'll notice here when I open up the browser, this is the browser I'm used to going to and going to websites, right? I'll cancel that. This is what I'm used to, that tabbed experience. But when I'm out on the start screen and I click Internet Explorer, and of course this resolution is not going to work. Let me see if I can change it real quick.
No, man, you'll blow things up.
I'm going to blow things up.
The producer will be mad at you.
If you open up Explorer from the start screen, it opens up in it's not modern, a different Internet Explorer. I want to be clear.
It's the same one, but it's optimized for touch, and it is called the modern user interface?
Yes, exactly. The Windows 8 application. The
user
Windows
interface
8
formerly
Internet
known
Explorer.
As...
you can't say that word.
Okay.
So if I'm out browsing around, if I'm out doing something, maybe I'm in an email and I get a link.
Ah. Oh, it always opens up in the modern one for me.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
What if I don't want it opening in that? I like to be in the desktop mode.
Okay. How do you do that?
How do I do that?
I want to see that.
Okay. I can show you.
Okay.
So go into Internet Explorer. We're going to go into Internet Options. We're going to go to Internet Options. And where did that guy go? There it is. Programs. Internet Options, Programs. It's really early, Rick. Sorry.
There you go.
Choose how you open links. You can let Internet Explorer decide, which is the default.
Right.
You can choose to always open in Internet Explorer, which is going to be the modern UI version. Or you can always open in Internet Explorer on the desktop.
Dude, are you serious?
Seriously.
Oh,
you just go in, you make that change,
yeah,
and boom, everything is in what you feel most comfortable with. Now, interestingly enough, when I'm at work and I'm on my work machine, I'm always opening things on the desktop because that's where I spend the bulk of my time.
Yep.
At home, however, I have a touch device.
Mm-hmm.
And at home, when I'm sitting, you know, in front of the TV watching sports and all the other crazy stuff, I like the touch interface.
Okay.
So I choose to always open in Internet Explorer because it's a better experience, particularly because if I'm on my Surface and I'm not using the keyboard because things in my lap, and I'm just kind of surfing around, I want to have that touch experience. So we can go ahead and set that there. A question I get often is, that's great, but I don't want to go around to every single system and actually make that modification. You see where I'm going here, Rick?
I'm sorry, I'm working on something.
Oh, okay. Of course he is. Of course he is.
Completely caught me off guard, man.
And I know it. I totally did that on purpose.
Called out.
Totally did that on purpose.
We're trying to multi... I'm getting set up by the next question.
Okay. So how do I actually do this at a broad scale? And the answer is group policy. And this is a policy just like anything else. So you can absolutely leverage group policy to do this. So I'm going to flip over to my management machine really quick because this is where I'm doing all of my management. Now, I could do what Rick said and add the domain controller in and do those things there, but I've already got group policy management here. So let's see, I've got to go under the domain and I've got some group policy objects. I've just created this one, Windows 8 management. There's really nothing in it. And we can go into the computer configuration. We'll go into administrative templates. It's a Windows component. And I'll do it on this side because it's a lot easier
to
see.
Maximize your window too there, good.
Yep, absolutely. Let's do that so folks at home can see. The mouse wants to be responsive. Internet Explorer. And then where is it located in the browser? Well, it's in Internet Settings, right? And there it is. Set how links are opened in Internet Explorer. I can go in. I can enable this policy. And then you'll see there are the options that I had before. Let IE decide. Always open in Internet Explorer. Always open on an Internet Explorer on the desktop.
Nice. So that can apply to all machines that this group policy applies to.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in this case, you know, if I'm managing a bunch of desktop systems inside my infrastructure, I'm going to go ahead and probably apply this to all of those systems. Or maybe I have a specific OU where they're touch-based systems, and I want everything default to open in that touch version, and I can absolutely do that. So there's another answer to another great question. Make sure you get those into the Q&A panel to do that.
I'm trying to get this guy set up, but you know what? So default for all Server 2012 environments is that they're set up for remote management in Server Manager and the ability to go off, and once their domain joined, to be able to go in, add them in, and then be able to manage your system. Those settings for which machines you have installed and any custom groups that you have installed on Server Manager is something that's stored inside a Server Manager XML file that you can then copy to multiple workstations so that whoever opens up Server Manager on those multiple workstations will have the same configuration of the systems they're looking at and custom nodes and groups that you happen to make. Someone was asking me, can I manage a down-level server in Server Manager? So can I manage a 2003 or a 2008 or 2008 R2 box inside Server Manager 2012 from a Windows 8 desktop or from a Windows Server 2012 system? And the answer is yes, with the exception of Server 2003. Server 2003 is not manageable by a RSAT tool or by the Server Manager tool in Server 2012. It is manageable using your legacy tools, but hopefully you've also moved on from Server 2003 or you're rapidly upgrading away from that because 2008 R2 is the last version out before Server 2012. To manage Server 2008 R2 systems on Server Manager, it is a very simple thing you have to do. I'm trying to get my system booted up and ready to go, but the reason why I talked about the auto management capabilities is because my dear friend Joey over here forgot to turn on remote desktop on my Server 2008 R2 box, so I can't remote into it to be able to show this.
Oh, do you need
me? I'm already in there. I'm already doing it here.
All right. Sorry, man. It was only 2 o'clock in the morning when we set that thing up.
Anyway, if you can flip back over here to my demo machine here. So as you can see, this is Server 2008 R2 system. It's up and running. It happens to be the main controller. If I go in here and I first of all go in and say bring up my h1box/source is my source directory files, you have to install a what's known as the Windows Management Framework 3.0. Now, there's a long list of things that Windows Management Framework 3.0 does and does not work with that you need to be able to read the KB article to learn about it. But basically, once you install this guy on a 2008 system, it's going to take a little bit of time. I downloaded the wrong one. Once you install that guy on the system with the proper version, because I downloaded the wrong version, I don't have enough time to go off and download the updated version. Once you've installed them, and the system now basically has PowerShell V2 on it, and it now has the Windows Management Framework, and has the proper version of .NET on there as well, it can now be remotely managed by a server manager box. And you simply have to go in, and just like Joey added in, right mouse click all servers, add server, you can pick that server from the list, and then be able to go off and manage it. There's one extra thing that you have to be able to do, is there is another hotfix that's required to be able to get the performance data to appear in Server Manager, which we didn't even show just yet, because it requires an update to be able to get performance data in there. The one thing you can't do with that particular utility, once it's been added in, is you can't use that lovely way of saying add, remove roles or features remotely on that box. You can't do that, because the install mechanism for Server 2008 R2 is different than the way that we do installs for 2012. And so basically, you get about 80% of your functionality that you want to have managing Server 2008 and 2008 R2 systems with Server Manager. That's there. That was my talking demo, which didn't work, so I just talked instead.
So I don't need to have an entirely different system to manage 2008 R2 while we're in this transition?
So long as you have a Windows 8 administrative workstation with RSAT tools installed, you can manage 2008, 2008 R2, and 2012 all from the one box.
Perfect.
But I will, again, caution you, make sure you read up on those products that you have installed on your 2008 and 2008 R2 systems to make sure that they aren't adversely affected, I guess I will say, by Windows Management Framework 3.0, because you are updating .NET and you are updating PowerShell.
Awesome.
You got it, man.
Awesome. More great stuff from the Q&A. Question on Windows 8. We're bouncing back and forth, so hopefully everybody's kind of
saving
this. We're trying to transition as best as we can. You talked about editions of Windows Server 2012,
yep.
So let me cover off the editions of Windows 8. There is Windows 8, which is kind of the home version that you would use. You've got Windows 8 Professional, steps it up a little bit, has a BitLocker in it, also has the ability to support another processor. And then you've got Windows 8 Enterprise. So one of the questions is, what's the difference between Pro and Enterprise? And it really comes down to the features that are available. Pro has pretty much everything that you need to do day-to-day stuff on in a lot of offices, but there are some enterprise-level features that you may want to take advantage of. An example of this would be BitLocker. Let's try that again, because BitLocker's in Pro. Branch cache is what I've meant to do.
Yeah.
Direct access. Windows to go, the ability to run Windows on a USB stick, are examples of some of these things that are only available in the Enterprise SKU. So, and then there's one other SKU that I haven't talked about, which is Windows RT, which is designed for ARM devices. Now, this guy altogether has some pretty significant differences in the fact that applications, the only applications that you can run on a Windows RT device are the applications that are available in the Windows Store. It does come pre-bundled with some Office software and some Office suites. We do have a desktop in Windows RT, so you still have the desktop, you still have the desktop IE. It's designed specifically for ARM devices, designed specifically for longer battery life, that small, nice touch form factor that you can take with you. So an example of that would be Surface RT. There's also a number of other Windows RT devices that I've played with. There's far too many of them. I've got one, which is the Vivo Tab RT from Asus. This is awesome because the tablet disconnects from an optional keyboard, and the tablet has, I believe it's 6 hours of battery life there, And then you add on the keyboard, which has an additional battery, and it adds like 9 or 10 hours.
No, that's sweet.
So you can just go forever on that. I just actually, back in December, went over to the UK and took a direct flight from Seattle over to Paris. And just as an example, I used my Surface, and I had a little SD card that I stuck in there with a whole bunch of television shows to get caught up on. And I watched it basically the entire flight, and I had a little bit more, or right around halfway of that battery life.
Nice.
Left, just sitting there watching watching that. Now, I did take a break when meal service came around.
I would
because
spill
I
stuff.
Love airplane food. I really, no.
I would say I'd spill stuff if that was me. Well, I'm good to go for another one if you got one. Are you still continuing? Or what?
I think I've kind of covered off the additions. I don't know that any additional questions have popped up in the Q&A panel. Again,
you know what?
Also,
people should go off and try the Windows Enterprise 90-day eval.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They should try it, but there's something I want to warn you.
Okay, so you can download it right now.
Yes.
Technet.microsoft.com/evalcenter, and you'll see, or just, you know, Springboard, whatever it happens to be, you'll find the link to download the 90-day eval of server of Windows 8.
And Server 2012,
And Server 2012, yes, but we have 180-day eval for ours.
Yes. 90-day eval for this version, and folks, you want to be sure that you understand the evaluation version cannot be upgraded.
You can't swap it out?
Can't swap it out.
Oof. Make sure you know that.
So you want to make sure that you're aware of that. Give it out. Give it a spin. When you're ready to go, you're going to have to basically restart from scratch there. So that's something that y'all, there's a great big huge warning all over. Make sure you know this. Make sure you understand this. I wanted to call it out as well.
Because we all know how well we read those EULAs.
Or any pop-up
or any other pop-up message that comes up during install.
Are you sure you want to do this? Are you really sure you want to do this? This will really break things, which is exactly the things that Rick kept clicking OK on last night. All right, server boy, what do you got?
Okay, flip back over here to my machine for a second. I want to talk a little bit about clustering. I do not want to go down the whole massive direction of virtualization and hypervisor and all sort of stuff. Let's just say Hyper-V that's included with Server 2012 as a role is phenomenal. Absolutely awesome for what you can do with it. And the one thing that I get asked an awful lot about at first is, geez, how do I set this guy up? There are so many different ways you can run this guy. You can run him as a standalone direct attached storage, and he's going to be working just fine. You can run him as a shared SaaS with a storage space like we are and make that storage space highly available with my two Hyper-V boxes. That also works just fine as well. You can also run him as a new way of doing things with the UNC name as the storage location of the VHD file. That is also completely usable and is actually architecturally rather interesting because a single point of failure on a Hyper-V cluster is the cluster shared volume. Right? If the cluster shared volume goes down, I'm basically out of luck because it's a single point of failure on a cluster environment. My VMs are going to be running and then they're going to be using that cluster shared volume, and if that volume goes down, I'm out of luck. Instead, if I have my servers running with the UNC name of a SMB3 SMB share that's been set up for Server 2012 and specifically says as a workload specific share, it can now become clustered up to 64 nodes, can be running on this guy, basically scale up file server, and you can now have your systems up and running where if a file server goes down running that share, your Hyper-V boxes will continue to run and they can be clustered, and if you know you can move your workload back and forth. So there was a question in the queue that came up, you know, which way is the best way to go? It again comes down to it depends architecturally. If you want to protect yourself the most, go with a scale-up file server as your back-end SMB3 share with proper architected storage, and then have a Hyper-V cluster talking to those particular systems as a storage location for your most aware things. Now, the reason why I came back in here is because I want to show you a failover cluster manager as the way to manage this sort of stuff. You can see here under roles that I have a whole bunch of different machines on H1 and on H2 of different systems. And yes, I can live migrate machines back and forth. So here's Joey's management machine on H1 without him even being consulted. I can go off here and say move over to live migration of the next best possible node, and he's being migrated and doesn't even know. So that's lovely. And it goes off and it works.
Sitting right here.
You're sitting there working on it and you won't even notice it's actually going on. That's nothing new. That was there before. In the past, we used to have a limitation that was there where you can only live migrate one workload at a time. I can actually go ahead and migrate three of his servers If I wanted to, right mouse click on there and say move live migration to best possible node, and off they go. So basically you're only limited by your hardware capabilities. When you set this up, the default is keep it to 2 so you don't overtax your systems. That's why only 2 are migrating right now. I could bump this up to 5 to 10 to 20, whatever I wanted to. So basically my limiting factor is my disk speed and my network speed between my two different boxes for live migration. Kind of cool stuff. The thing I wanted to show you as well in this is when you start having these clusters, because now clusters can be up to 64 nodes in Server 2012, you have to worry about updates. And it used to be a big, ugly, manual process to your updates. Now you can do what's known as cluster-aware updating of my underlying infrastructure. So we had to worry about patch revisions on our servers last night for node 1 and node number 2.
Yes.
I can go in, now that they're up and running, and simply configure it to say, go ahead and do a cluster aware update of my systems. And what that means is if I have, in this case, 2 nodes in my cluster, it'll go in, identify those 2 nodes, and I can say, let's first of all start off this wizard. It's going to analyze the system, what's going to go on. It will go in, and once it's been set up with my criteria, either manually when I click on the button, it'll go in and say, okay, I need to do an update. Go in and check my source for updates, move my workloads over for the least busy node to the other guy, and then go ahead and do the patches. When the patches are done, reboot the box, come back in, join the cluster when it comes back up and passes my internal tests, move that workload back to that node, so node number 2, let's say. And then I go in and say, okay, node number 1, you're ready to go. It's going to go in and move the workload off node number 1, and then it's going to go in and apply the patches, make sure it all comes back up again, everything's all good, and then move the workload back over to node number 1 again. It rebalances itself back at it again. Continue to node 3, node 4, node 5, node 6, node 7, all the way up to 64. If at any point in time one of those nodes happens to fail for some reason for an update, it can roll back those individual updates on all the individual previously done nodes. This is automation, my folks, my friends, and that allows you to go ahead and do this in such a way that you can schedule this to take place maybe a week after Patch Tuesday. So you've done your test, you're sure it's all good, and it'll go in and migrate workloads off, do the patch, do the checks. If it takes too long, roll it back. If it's completed and doesn't pass tests, roll it back. If it is all done, move those workloads back in again. Now here it's going in and doing an analysis, and it's giving me error messages because I have not set this up as of yet. So basically I got some warning messages, you know, that you need to go in and get it all set to go. So I wanted to show you that. Do your evaluation first. Then you go in and you configure it. And it's a wizard interface that basically says, you know what, get that particular guy on there, get him installed. This is my routine. In this case, it happens to be the third Tuesday of every month is the default. That's going to go through and do my installs. My advanced options allows me to go ahead and have a set of criteria. Stop after running for so long. Warn me after so long. How many nodes it should try before it rolls back. Blah, blah, blah. Lots of different stuff. And then I can choose to go to Windows Update for my source, or I can choose to go to a hotfix plugin instead. So basically, if I have a hotfix that has to be applied, I can go and do one or the other. I'm just going to say Windows Update. Go in and hit Next. And says, okay, are we all set? Hit next. Confirmation, hit apply, and it's going to go off and install the role on my system and then configure it to be ready to go and run. Now, we did all those updates last night.
Yes.
We don't have to worry about this, but I could go off and run the evaluation when this is complete. And basically, this guy is now set on autopilot. You don't have to do autopilot. You can say, don't do it automatically, only when I click on apply updates to this cluster button in the top right-hand corner, or I can say do it on a schedule. So that's how you maintain your clusters up to date for cluster aware updating.
Awesome.
Sweetness.
Awesome. I want to kind of kick off, tick off some of these, some quick answers that we can do in the Q&A
12
panel.
12 minutes remaining.
That, wow, time flies.
You got it.
Let's see. So let's talk about in Server 2008, we have the desktop experience available. Do we have the same in Windows Server 2012? So the desktop experience.
Yes.
Where basically we convert our
it is not enabled by default, laptops, but it can be enabled.
Same way. So just like we did it in 2008.
Just like I removed the interface, there was that middle checkbox, which was the equivalent of the desktop experience. You can turn that guy on, and you can have it. Why you would want to, I don't know.
Well, if you're running it on, say, a laptop, right? I mean, I know. And again, this is one
you
of those things.
You don't need to. Windows 8 with RSAT tools.
And Hyper-V.
Clipervisor.
Yes, the Clipervisor.
To use Rose's example, his existence there.
I don't know if this is a short answer or not. In terms of Hyper-V and clustering and what you just talked about, iSCSI, SMB, is there... I know it's kind of like one of those questions.
It's still one of those, it depends.
Yeah.
My preference is, personally speaking, because I would be doing a greenfield install, I don't want to outlay a huge chunk of cash. It's cheaper to get JBOD enclosures with shared SAS connected controller cards to connect up to those JBODs and then make storage spaces. Once you've got that, you've got enterprise type or enterprise class storage capabilities inside a box that is not a SAN environment. Once you've done that, if you have the resources, you can have a highly available file server and then have Hyper-V using that highly available file server, SMB share, as the location for being able to do stuff. That gives you super blazing fast speed of SMB3, multiple sessions available to SMB3, multiple capabilities, and SMB3 is optimized to be run with file handles open on constantly open files if it's been set up as a workload share as opposed to a regular everyday open and close document type share. So that's my personal preference for putting all the architectural eggs spread across as many baskets as you can.
Gotcha.
But you can get away with direct attached storage, you can get away with iSCSI if you wanted to, but you're just putting other stuff in front of the natural goodness that is storage spaces.
There's another question here that I want to address that relates to connected standby. So connected standby in Windows 8, this would be if you've got a
server,
tablet device.
Talking about.
No, it's not. So that's why I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
So connected standby, if you've got a Windows 8 device, a tablet device, and it goes into that kind of low power saving mode, or sleep, so to speak, applications can still run a little bit in the background. And the question was directly related to Skype. Does Skype support connected standby? And the answer to that is yes. There's been an update recently that enables connected standby with Skype. So what happens is when those Microsoft push servers know that, get that notification that needs to come out and contact you, that there's an incoming call, incoming IM, those push servers will then send a request out to the application that's connected to wake it up, and then your tablet device will start to ring. So I can wake you up in the middle of the night by Skyping you if you've got Skype still running and connected standby on your machine. So there's an answer to that question as well.
I want to do a shout out to Irshad Miraz. He's on the Q&A. He's asking me to answer a question, but unfortunately his question is scroll off the list. I don't see it there anymore. I apologize, my friend, but I'm assuming your question got answered. That was one guy I wanted to shout out to because he's pinged me twice on this.
Another question here, Rick, I hope you can answer this. Is Server Manager context sensitive for the older versions of the OS? So we talked about managing Server 2008 R2.
It does detection of what roles are installed, like is it the main controller, is it DNS, is it DHCP, but that's really, you know, think of your major infrastructure pieces. It's not going to know it's an Exchange box. It's not going to know it's a SharePoint box, whatever it is. But it'll detect if you've got IIS, it'll detect if you've got one of those major infrastructure services.
Man, where is this time going? There's a bunch of questions I want to get to here. There's one here I'd love to show you the demo of. I think it's just going to consume the rest of our time. I want to make sure we get the most questions answered. But the question was a procedure to import group policy templates for Windows 8 on a Windows Server 2008 R2 domain controller. These are essentially the ADMX files.
Yep.
So you can go in and you can actually mount up the WIM file.
Yep.
Or actually go to a Windows 8 installed machine, and you can grab all the ADMX ADM files, right, that are in the policies definition folder under /Windows.
The administrative templates you're talking about.
Yep, these are all the administrative templates so that you can set group policy on, and then you can import them into your group policy store. Now, there are two different procedures on how to do this. One is if you just want to manage it on a single machine and not have a central group policy store, and the concept of group policy stores came about I want to say it was in Server 2003. I'm pretty sure it was in Server 2003. It may have been earlier. I apologize if I'm completely wrong. But it's the ability to store all of those ADM files and those ADMX files out on sysfile, right? So it's replicated around the domain controllers. You can do it there. So you would go to the percent sysfile percent and go find those the location of your central store, and you copy in those ADMX files that will support the Windows 8 systems. If you're just doing it on a single system, it's I'm just going to do a quick look here in my notes because I actually just wrote it down. It's percent system root percent slash policy definitions. So if we really wanted to, I just do system root just because people sometimes install Windows to different directories. Policy definitions, copy those files in. And then the other piece, the other caveat, is that we make sure that we're setting the right settings for the right OS.
Mm-hmm.
right? So you can move it to the central store, and there's articles out on TechNet that talk exactly how to do this, some walkthroughs out on that. So you can just go out and search TechNet for this. There's a walkthrough on the Windows 8, Windows Server 2012. There's one for 2008, managing Windows 7, Server 2003, managing Windows 7, XP, Vista, those kinds of things. So they're there. We have that ability. I wish I could show it to you. I think that demo would just take quite a bit longer because I don't have the store set up. I was actually going to do it as part of the demo. But I wanted to kick off that question.
I got one. I can do one more for the server, but server dude. If you can flip over to my machine, I'm not going to show a demo. I'm going to show you a blog post that a premier field engineer has done up about how to clone a virtual domain controller. So with Hypervisor on Server 2012, we support a new functionality that is called VMGenID. And because we support VMGenID, we've made the spec available to other vendors of virtualization hypervisors as well. It allows you to safely have a 2012 domain controller virtualized and support the ability to have a snapshot applied to it without creating a USN bubble of passwords being out of sync and objects being created with duplicate SIDs, provided you're running a hypervisor, Server 2012, or any other hypervisor that supports VMGenID. This particular blog post, I'll have a short version of that URL. I'm going to basically point to it on my blog on regularit.com. Basically, he does a fantastic job of being able to show you how cloning a domain controller actually works as a deployment mechanism. Because in the past, you would have to get a member server, sysprep it, duplicate the files, bring it up, give it a new computer name, do a DC promo, and then replicate and all sorts of yada, yada, yada stuff. Here, you literally add the computer account of the source to a group. So a domain controller at Server 2012, add it to a group. You then, on that box, go in and run one PowerShell command that will create this ADMX file. And it's right here on my screen to show you how simple that one particular command line is. It'll go in and put the necessary files in the right spot so that when this box gets exported off of the VM hypervisor and then re-imported on a different box, it will say, oh, hey, it's done in such a way that it is actually a copy of that first one. So because these files exist, go off and do a bunch of stuff that will allow me to have a cloned domain controller. So it checks, does the group security exist? Yes, it does. It's from a proper source. Does it have the proper file? Yes, it does, because that PowerShell command puts that proper file in the right spot. How do I find my IP address configuration information? And then, poof, up it comes. You can clone your domain controllers as a rapid deployment option for getting Server 2012 domain controllers out there like that.
Awesome.
Fantastic stuff.
Awesome, awesome. I want to shout out to Clyde Jackson, who set me straight saying central stores are available in Server 2008 and later, not 2003. I guess I've just been playing around with far too many versions and I get it all confused. So thanks, Clyde, for setting me straight on that one. Dude, we've got like 2 minutes-ish left in this. I want to also thank everybody who participated in the Q&A. I see David Testars out there. I know I saw Brett Baird. Avi is just the man. Whew. As it relates to Q&A. He's been burning through them. So thanks you guys for your questions. Hopefully you guys found this really valuable. This is kind of the trial run, so to speak.
You got it.
Of this particular.
Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. There is a poll questions up there right now. We'd love it if you take a moment to answer that one there. Basically, has this MVA office hour session changed your perception of Windows 8 and Server 2012? Hopefully it's been greatly improved. There are additional, obviously, jump starts, multiple day sessions on Server 2012 and on Windows 8. You can go off and take a look at as recorded, previously recorded, if you want to go back to it. This is our first one, and I think we're done, my friend. Oh, we got 2 minutes left.
We got 2 minutes. Here, let me ask a quick question. Home server user, how does Windows 8 run with it? Any compatibility issues? I can tell you, speaking strictly from experience, I'm running home server. I'm actually running an earlier version than the person in the Q&A panel asked, and I've not had any issues with this. It just, I mean, again, like I said, I'm kind of a music freak, so that's actually where a lot of the music and my kids' photos are stored. So I don't have major issues that I've come across, but I'm sure somebody could probably contribute that. Let's see, just kind of quickly. Thanks everybody. I'm just trying to make sure. People are asking for links to the blog post in the VM.
I'm getting into the questions
piece,
in just 1 second.
Rick will make sure he
regularitguy.com. There'll be a blog post later today.
Yeah, there you go. regularitguy.com. Again, folks, thank you so much. Make sure you hit that poll question. Let us know if this was valuable for you, because I had a great time. Rick, thank you for all the work that that you helped out on there.
Thanks for sticking around last night to make sure things were working.
Absolutely.
Nothing like nuking your demo systems just to get things to work, you know, less than 12 hours before you start.
Yeah, when you saw on Twitter, I actually published that, you know, things that you don't want to hear less than 12 hours before session, I'm just going to nuke it. As Rick said, to Jeff, our amazing producer,
I just got tired of it.
And everybody out there, thanks for joining us for MVA Office Hours, our initial run. Let us know if you like it. Hit those, hit that survey. Let us know. That's it, dude. We're done.
You know, we got a couple more. We're going to answer inside the queue just by text. For those of you that are still here, I just posted the link to that cloning domain controllers blog post. But we're out.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's it.
You know what? Go try MVA, MicrosoftVirtualAcademy.com. Go try out those courses and...
Don't forget those 50 bonus points.
MVA.
Yep, Microsoft Virtual Academy. You get those 50 bonus points. Shameless self-promotion MVA course for Windows 8, now available.
Nice.
It's new.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
We're done.
Have a good day.